Today, helicopter money for the rich, the DFA Daily to the 11th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In the real world, the health crisis is driving people to unemployment queues, closing businesses, and locking people in their homes. But in the financial world, it seems the markets are up and more are talking about a bull market run. The raw numbers are these. US stocks ended higher, but off their best levels, after the Fed announced a $2.3 trillion in loans to aid the economy during the current crisis, overshadowing a record 6.6 million in jobless claims this week, while the Fed balance sheet grew by another 4.8% to more than $6 trillion. Stocks lost ground following an OPEC Plus deal on oil production cuts, as this agreement fell short of what the markets were expecting. And WTI crude prices swung wildly through the day, rising as much as 13% and falling as much as 10%, before settling down 9.3% at 22.76. And over the shorter Easter week, the S&P jumped 12.1% for its biggest one-week gain since 1974, while the Dow rose 12% and the Nasdaq lifted 10.6%. The financial sector, up 5.3%, topped the leaderboards, and JP Morgan was up 9%, leading the Dow higher. The 10-year US Treasury fell 3 basis points to 0.73%. In March, we experienced the most violent correction in history, not just in the US, but globally, as this chart of the Canadian market shows. Yet now, more bulls are saying that the S&P 500 is now more than 20% higher than its mid-March lows, so therefore we're officially in a bull market. But really? Generally, stock prices reflect expected future revenue flows and profits, but given the current shutdowns, I cannot see how anybody can estimate what these might be. Closed for a month? For 3 months? A year or longer? Who knows? This is frankly partly hope over expectation, but it is also powered by the view that the Fed and other central banks will not let markets fall. While the market's rally since its March 23rd low has been massive, it's actually not unprecedented. The Dow was created in the late 1800s, and since then there have been 38 other occasions where it rallied just as much or more in just a shorter period. All of them occurred during the Great Depression. And another indicator of risk is the volatility index. Looking at it from 1990, it shows that the VIX almost always hits its high well before bear markets register their final lows. While a bottom can occur early in a recession, they generally do not fall outside of a recession. And in the last several recessions, the market bottom was hit late in the recession. And yes, I am assuming there is going to be a global recession and that we've already entered the early stages, as the IMF, the BIS and the WTO are all suggesting. And this signals the likelihood of further market falls ahead at some point. And now consider this. In the US, the consumer makes up over 2/3 of the economy. Some projections are for 30% plus unemployment rates for the next quarter or two. A recent Wall Street Journal survey suggested the annual level was going to spike to 13% in June and drop a little to around 10% by December. Economists are predicting the second quarter annualized contraction to be around 25%. With these types of numbers, you would expect carnage in the stock market, and while the market sits around 20% off its all-time highs made in February, it's surged since March the 23rd. To the tune of about 20%. Now you ask, how is that possible when we are confronted with the worst economic situation since the Great Depression? But the stock market's in a bubble. How can that be? Well, the answer is, of course, that the Fed is underwriting and backstopping capitalism, period. Back in the financial crisis, the Fed pumped around $2 trillion into the market. Then it extended QE2 and QE3, and the balance sheet got to between $4 and $5 trillion. Now, with the stock market falling over 30% in the fastest decline ever, what did they do? They announced unlimited QE, of course, with their balance sheet expanding now at $1 million per second. And the expectation now is that it will reach around $9 trillion. So it's no wonder we're seeing asset prices push higher. Now, of course, if a private sector company did this, it would be blatant market manipulation, but then the Fed is different. Behind this is the continuing story of the GFC, as banks got greedy and over-leveraged themselves, lending out predatory loans and being hugely irresponsible to bolster their bottom lines, a recession hit. Banks were caught. Terrible oversight, manipulation, illegality, and shaky morals were all behind it. Banks were going bankrupt, corporate CEOs were scrambling, and the stock market was crashing fiercely. But then the Fed threw an expensive lifeline, a multi-trillion dollar bailout. Taxpayers were left holding the corporate baby, despite the fact that for decades, the corporates had been skimming customers with increasing fees and making illegal predatory lending processes to people who did not know any better. And why couldn't they just be left to go bankrupt? Well, simply because they had highly influential lobby groups that said we were better off to keep them afloat. So the Fed started printing big, metaphorically, actually it's all electronic transactions, to keep the corporate financial system afloat. So back to the current QE on steroids. The total assets on the Fed's weekly balance sheet jumped by $272 billion in 1 week to $6.08 trillion. Since the Fed started this spree of Wall Street and asset holder bailout programs a month ago, total assets have exploded by $1.77 trillion. But then, the increase of $272 billion is less than half of the increases in the prior 2 weeks, a mere 4.8% growth, compared with the lift of 12% a couple of weeks back. The assets on the Fed's balance sheet are mostly composed of Treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities, repurchase agreements, foreign central bank liquidity swaps, and loans. As part of its bailout scheme, the Fed now operates dollar liquidity swap lines with the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and central banks of Canada, England, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark, Singapore, South Korea, Brazil, and Mexico. The lion's share of the outstanding balances are on the Bank of Japan, $193 billion, and the ECB at $141 billion. Trailing far behind is the Bank of England at just $22 billion. There has been no activity with central banks of Canada, Australia, Brazil, New Zealand, and Sweden so far. The Fed's weekly balance sheet closes on Wednesday evening each week, at which point the total outstanding swap balances were $358 billion, up by $9 billion from the previous week. And during the week of the balance sheet, the Fed purchased $109 billion gross of mortgage-backed securities, or MBS, bringing in the total of gross purchases of MBS since March the 11th to $428 billion. The MBS market was blowing up, mortgage real estate trusts were blowing up, mortgage rates were rising under that pressure, and the Fed decided to bail everyone out rather than let the market sort this out. Yet, they might also be on course to pump up equity markets without even having to go to a middle ground like buying Treasury securities. Former Fed Chair Janet Yellen made a plea that Congress should convene and allow the Fed to purchase equities like Japan is doing, an instrument of the US government being allowed to buy publicly traded securities. If you backstop capitalism and stop companies from trading on a free market, letting the winners win and the losers lose, is that, well, socialism? What is it? It's an excellent time to be a publicly traded company, that's what it is. You can buy back your stocks and spit out dividends in the good times, even borrowing to do so. But when times get tough and there's a recession, no problem, the Fed will bail you out and the taxpayer will foot any bill. Now that shouldn't create any moral hazard problems, should it? privatize the profits, socialize the losses. This is how you get companies' stock performance into bubble territory, by making unprofitable business appear profitable by government bailouts. And speaking of bubbles, it also seems that the taxpayer is going to be funding some free loans to US small businesses soon. The Paycheck Protection Program, which is part of the CARES Act, is providing loans to small businesses with up to 500 employees. It could provide loans to small businesses up to $10 million each and has a price tag of about $349 billion to taxpayers. Not only that, but those loans could be forgivable when used to keep people employed. In fact, $151 billion has already been approved. That's five times the normal annual funding. And there are many businesses being rejected or finding it difficult to submit a funding request. And remember this, if the Fed had sent that $1.77 trillion to the 130 million households in the US, each household would have received $13,600. But no, this was helicopter money exclusively for Wall Street and for asset holders. And a quick further word about mortgage forbearance. The US stimulus package signed into law on the 27th of March mandates that all borrowers with government-backed mortgages be allowed to delay for at least 90 days their monthly mortgage payments. Homeowners impacted by this national emergency are eligible for a forbearance plan to reduce or suspend their mortgage payments for up to 12 months. And during that period, homeowners won't have to make mortgage payments. They will not incur late fees. They will not be reported to the credit bureaus. So this won't hit their credit score. And after forbearance, the mortgage servicer must work with them on a permanent plan to help maintain or reduce monthly payment amounts as necessary, including a loan modification. So the deferred payments will have to be rolled into the rest of the mortgage, but it will be a modified mortgage, perhaps with stretched terms and lower rates. Now, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, between the week of March the 2nd and the week of March the 16th, forbearance requests grew by 1,270%. And between the week of March 16th and the week of March 30th, forbearance requests grew by another 1,896%. Forbearance requests already exceed 2 million. And the average hold times at mortgage services call centres jumped from less than 2 minutes 3 weeks earlier to 17.5 minutes. And an estimated 2 million borrowers already missed mortgage payments by the end of May, some estimates, and they could be deliberately exaggerated to trigger a bailout for the non-bank mortgage services, say that forbearance will reach 25% of government-backed mortgages. But when homeowners don't have to make payments for up to a year, it throws the entire mortgage market upside down. And one of the side effects is that it puts mortgage services into a liquidity crunch, as they have a contractual obligation to continue to make the payments to mortgage-backed security holders, even if homeowners become delinquent. Services will be reimbursed by the government-backed entities, but that can take several months, so they are temporarily at least on the hook, but will eventually get their money back. While banks have large cash reserves that they keep around or deposit them at the Fed and have liquidity support from the Fed and can borrow at the discount window of 0.25%, non-banks or shadow banks have neither. They're not regulated by the Fed and other banking regulators. They don't have the capital reserves and capital requirements that banks have. And now they don't have the reserves to get through this crisis. In fact, Fed Chair Jerome Powell already indicated recently in a webinar at Brookings that the Fed was looking at this whole sector.
One of the things that distinguishes this period, which is pretty extraordinary, is what's going on in the mortgage market. We've seen a sharp spike in delinquencies. It's hard to for people to buy. It's even hard for people to refinance mortgages. There's questions about the mortgage servicers. Do you think there are steps that need to be taken now by the government, broadly defined, to make sure that a mortgage crisis doesn't make the economic recovery slower than need be?
Well, so a couple of things. First, I think the CARES Act does provide a moratorium on payments for some time for some mortgage holders. But you're absolutely right. The mortgage market is at the very center of our economy and very important for the real economy. That's why we bought so many mortgage-backed securities at such a historically aggressive pace over the last few weeks. We feel like the mortgage, that market, which is where an awful lot of individual home and other mortgages wind up, is now functioning more properly. We're watching carefully the situation with the mortgage servicers. And I will just tell you that we certainly have our eyes on that as a key market that does support households and consumer spending, really, which is, of course, 70% of the economy. So we'll be watching that carefully.
And the conclusion is that if you squeal loud enough, you'll get a Fed bailout. And Jerome Powell was at pains to stress that there is governance over the use of their tools, though at best it's indirect. And of course, the Fed is privately owned by the big banks, unlike central banks in many other countries, including Australia.
It's cut interest zero. You've bought hundreds of billions worth of treasury bonds and mortgages. You've launched an alphabet soup of lending programs, including some new ones today for state and local governments and mid-sized businesses that you say could lend up to $2.3 trillion. Is there any limit to how much money the Fed can create, how much it can lend without having some unwelcome side effects like inflation or asset price bubbles?
So I'll just say that these programs that we're using under the law, we do these with the consent, as I mentioned in my remarks, with the consent of the Treasury Secretary and with fiscal backing from the Congress through Treasury. And we're doing it to provide credit to households, businesses, state and local governments, as we are directed by the Congress. And we're using that fiscal backstop to absorb any losses that we have. And what we've been doing is looking for places that are very important to the real economy, things that really affect people's lives and economic output, and where credit to those parts of the economy has broken down. Those are the ones I've mentioned. And so that's essentially what we're doing. And we can keep doing that as long as those needs arise. Our ability to do that is limited really by the law. We have to find unusual and exigent circumstances. The Treasury Secretary has to agree. And we are using this fiscal backstop. But there's no limit on how much of that we can do other than that it must meet the tests under the law as amended by Dodd-Frank.
But isn't there a risk that with all this money coming out of Congress, the money that we're lending, that we'll end up with something that we don't like, as in more inflation than we'd like or asset price bubbles?
You know, so inflation has been an interesting phenomenon. Back when 12 years ago, when the financial crisis was getting going and the Fed was doing quantitative easing, many people feared that the increases in the money supply that were as a result of quantitative easing asset purchases would result in high inflation. Not only did it not happen, the challenge has become that inflation has been below our target. So that is globally the challenge has been inflation below target. And honestly, it is not a first order concern for us today that too high inflation might be coming our way in the near term. Far from it. There are certainly, I would say, these are programs that we're developing at a high rate of speed. We don't have the luxury of, of taking our time the way we usually do. We're trying to get help quickly to the economy as it's needed. And I worry that, in hindsight, you will see that we could have done things differently. But one thing I don't worry about is inflation right now.
The Fed is not at all concerned about the possibility of this stimulus creating inflation. And this is consistent with my view that the greatest risk to economies is a Japan-style stagflation or depression rather than hyperflation, which, by the way, is one reason why I suspect physical gold prices will fall ahead. And oil is another factor in the mix. We are currently in the midst of a historic oil price crash after crude prices fell more sharply on March the 9th than they had on any single day in nearly 30 years, a whopping 30%. This was driven by multiple events, from the health issues. International oil demand quickly took a dive. Saudi Arabia and Russia, the leading members of OPEC Plus, began to talk strategy. But the alliance fell apart and morphed into an all-out oil price war. As more economies have slowed, the glut persists, hence low oil prices. Now, Trump is being lobbied by US shale oil producers to impose tariffs. And while Trump had said that he was going to let the market self-regulate, now the United States president seems to be changing his tune, threatening to impose very substantial tariffs on oil imports to the United States. A global deal to cut oil production and save the market from the health crisis-induced breakdown proved elusive at the end of last week, as a diplomatic initiative led by Saudi Arabia suffered repeated setbacks. After 2 days of talks, the kingdom still hadn't resolved differences with Mexico that would allow its agreement for a record 10 million barrel a day supply reduction to proceed. Delek said negotiations continued at a high level with some progress. Mexico later said that they would move forward thanks to a deal with the US to help shoulder the reductions US President Donald Trump said he would propose to help Mexico along. The US would reduce its output and Mexico would reimburse the US at some later date, he added, that he wasn't sure the deal would be accepted. All but one nation among the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies endorsed the production cut, which is equivalent to about 10% of global supply. Mexico insisted that it could only cut by 100,000 barrels a day, not the 400,000 plus that OPEC was originally asking. Now, if Saudi Arabia can overcome the obstacles and lead the world to a 15 million barrel a day production cut, it would be a historical achievement. However, it would also be just a fraction of the 20 million to 35 million barrels a day in estimated global demand losses, as billions of people stay confined to their homes and businesses close to slow the spread of the health issue. Hi, excuse the interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now back to the current show. And one other important factor to consider is China's role in supporting the global economy ahead, bearing in mind that in the years after the 2008 crash, its massive stimulus became the primary engine of global growth. Its stature rose alongside that of new multilateral groups such as the G20, and it developed an arsenal of arguments against market-driven economic and political order that the West had long promoted. After the last crisis, China's 4 trillion yuan stimulus spurred demand and lifted commodity prices to new highs globally, keeping dozens of less developed countries afloat. Stimulus-guzzling Chinese companies wandered the world, investing in commodity-rich economies. Today, China has far less money to throw about. According to Bloomberg Economics, relative to past successes during the last crisis, we should expect China to take a more measured approach. Worse, those stimulus-fueled shopping binges have led to an awkward hangover. China is now a huge and often hidden creditor in some of the world's most indebted countries, many of which are being forced by the health issues to choose between death and default. This hampers global efforts to help such nations. The IMF and the World Bank want creditors to suspend their debt payments temporarily. So do the African Union's finance ministers. Outright debt relief, however, is complicated by fear that any payments would in fact bail out Chinese lenders or protect the revenues of Chinese state-controlled investors in those economies. Last year, US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo complained that any IMF package for Pakistan should not, quote, go to bail out Chinese bondholders or China itself. In some ways, this is a far deeper crisis for emerging markets than back in 2008. The scale of capital flight is sobering, $83 billion in March, according to the Institute for International Finance. This comes at a time when the IIF says emerging markets' overall debt-to-GDP ratio is at a fresh high of 220% of GDP, up from 147% in 2007. Western banks and multilateral institutions have yet to respond at scale to the growing crisis in emerging nations. The World Bank has already approved $1.9 billion in emergency lending, with $1 billion going to India's healthcare sector alone. China's challenger, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, well, it's arranged its first post-health crisis loan, which was $355 million for public health infrastructure in Beijing. And that seems a pretty poor opening bid, in my view. Now, over in Hong Kong, Bloomberg says the city has led the world in adopting helicopter money. Now the city's long-term wage subsidies have again put it at the forefront of global efforts to blunt the impact of the health issues. The government said this week that it would fund 50% of active workers' salaries for 6 months, capped an equivalent of $1,160 a month. With the exception of Australia, most countries have offered shorter-term relief. Hong Kong's spending package reflects recognition that the economy will need support for longer than initially thought. Hong Kong's relief package isn't the biggest around by any means. Its total fiscal stimulus amounts to around 10% of GDP, compared with 12% for Singapore and 20% for Japan. On its own, the $10.3 billion job security package amounts to 2.8% of the city's GDP, according to Bloomberg. The duration is what makes it stand out. Singapore is doling out 75% of salaries capped at the equivalent of $3,231 for the month of April. The UK is covering 80% of wages for 3 months, with a ceiling of $3,107 starting at the end of April. And the US, meanwhile, is giving out enhanced unemployment benefits and a one-time check of $1,200 as part of its $2 trillion stimulus bill. It isn't aimed directly to keep people in work. The sustained government action that Hong Kong is now undertaking runs counter to its laissez-faire DNA. If the city's venture into direct cash distribution to individuals in February was a canary in the coal mine for the global economy, this may be another. Expect the recovery from the pandemic to be slow and painful and to require government support for much longer than many countries are currently anticipating. And Britain has approved 4 new lenders to offer government-backed loans to struggling small businesses damaged by the health outbreak. Under the multi-billion pound business interruption loan scheme, the 4 banks, Cooperative, Synergy, Oak North and Starling, join more than 40 existing banks who are accredited lenders. The government-backed British business bank BBB said in a statement on Saturday, the bank would now be setting up operations required to start lending under the rescue scheme and will soon confirm the dates from which they will be ready to start receiving applications. The scheme was first announced by British Finance Minister Rishi Sunak on March the 17th as part of a £330 billion support package for businesses hit by the country's lockdown. It's been beset by problems with many businesses struggling to access cash quickly or finding that they were ineligible, while some digital lenders are not included. So again, there are significant executional issues. Meanwhile, back here in Australia, I simply could not believe a recent news.com article claiming the time is right for first home buyers. Consider their logic. Investors, they say, have taken a back seat. So since the eviction moratorium, investors have cooled and the result is a quieter playing field for first home buyers. Investors have exited the market, leaving more options for first home buyers. The reason is that property investor calculus no longer works. And many are heading to the exits, as my recent forced sale analysis shows. Next, they say, interest rates couldn't be more interesting. It's never been cheaper to pay off a home loan. Many first home buyers' parents or grandparents took on mortgages with interest rates as high as 17% in the late 1980s and early 1990s. But today's rates are rock bottom. CoreLogic data even suggests that more than a third of Australian properties had estimated mortgage repayments less than local weekly rents. Third, they say, lenders are hungry for business. Even before the current crisis, lenders had loosened their belts for first-time borrowers. By July 2019, APRA had relaxed restrictions around how lenders assessed a customer's ability to meet repayments by dropping the required buffer from a minimum interest rate of 7% to 2.5%. As a result, it's easier to get finance than it was even a couple of years ago. Couple that with a loss of interest from investors, and banks are very willing to chat to first-timers. Unless, of course, you're employed in certain industries like retail or hospitality and risk losing your job. And committing to a mortgage at this time of uncertainty, well, I think is pretty much nuts. And then they said sellers are more willing to meet the market. A lot of sellers, some say as many as 40 to 50%, withdrew their properties from the market as soon as social distancing measures came in. Many were fearful of how property prices would fare in the coming weeks, or were scared of letting strangers wander through their home. But those sellers who are ready to sell or have to sell are now more prepared than ever to listen to offers. Sure, prices are falling, but actually they will fall further ahead. And sellers are looking for, as Tony LeCantro said some time ago, quote, a greater fall. And then finally, they said government handouts are still on the table. Lockdown laws have changed the way real estate is sold for the foreseeable future, but government assistance for first home buyers has stayed the same. Each state and territory government has its own version of the first home owner grant and exemptions to stamp duty, which can be found by visiting firsthome.gov.au. On the 1st of January this year, the federal government kickstarted its first home loan deposit scheme, which assists eligible first home buyers to get onto the property ladder with a deposit of as low as 5%. In the wake of the health issues, the government has extended the 90-day time frame for finding a home to 180 days. And sure, the government and banks want you to buy to support the economy. But frankly, I would urge great caution in these uncertain times. In past downturns, it is first-time buyers who were the last in, lost the most, and were either forced to sell later or forced to sit in negative equity for years. Remember that prices will be lower in the months ahead. And I think that whole article, frankly, is totally irresponsible journalism. But hey, they're connected to the property industry, so what would you expect? And just on Australian home prices, this is what REA's Nerida Conesby said just recently.
One thing I'm getting asked almost every single day at the moment is what will happen to house prices as a result of COVID-19. At this stage, it really is too early to tell. But what we can say for certain is that looking back in every property downturn, some areas will be far more impacted than others. So how do we determine which areas will see the greatest drop in prices and which areas will hold steady? This downturn is not a financial-driven downturn. It is a productivity downturn. And so any increases in unemployment will have a big impact on the property market. In every downturn, we do see variable impacts across Australia. In the global financial crisis, premium suburbs of Sydney did very badly. In the early 1990s recession, prices fell rapidly in Melbourne and Adelaide, but picked up on the Gold Coast as people from both those cities moved north. This time around, we are seeing increases in employment in the government sector. All that stimulus that has been released into the economy will require more people working in Centrelink, ATO, and also the Department of Health. The one market which will be most impacted by this will be Canberra. And already we are seeing far more positive conditions in this market compared to the rest of Australia. The other market that may see a pickup is Perth. We are continuing to see high levels of iron ore exports, and the gold price has hit a record high in Australia. Next year, most gold being exported around the world will come from Australia. As every week goes by and we get better and better data around how people are looking on realestate.com.au and what's happening to listings, we will get a clearer idea as to what will happen to pricing. For now, if you are a seller, there are people out there looking to buy, although obviously it has dropped off over the past month. If you are a buyer, there are still a lot of properties available on the market. At this stage, however, it is unlikely that you will find a bargain, as there are still very low levels of distressed listings.
Actually, she makes a number of good points, not least that price movements do vary by type of property and by different locations. Finally, a further word on Bitcoin as it dropped back to its low time frame support of $6,800, with bulls ardently attempting to defend against the crypto dropping beneath this level. One prominent hedge fund manager is noting that Bitcoin has established some strong overhead resistance that is likely to damage its near-term market structure, providing investors with an ideal shorting opportunity. Mark Dow, a prominent hedge fund manager and economist, explained that he's growing increasingly bearish on Bitcoin due to strong overhead resistance that has just been established above its current price level. He notes that this resistance provides investors with a, quote, textbook opportunity to enter short positions, signaling that he anticipates the crypto to move lower in the days and weeks ahead. And so the conclusion is clear. If you have powerful lobby powers, are a large corporation, and are feeling the burn from the current economic predicament, you can expect help from your friends, the central bankers. Actions willingly supported by politicians, even if they claim some arm's length relationships. This will likely prop up the market to an extent for some time, although the truth is they will probably fall eventually. But real, ordinary households and businesses are under the gun, and yet eventually we will all have to pay for these excesses, even as the rich minority once again laugh all the way to the bank. Thanks, central bankers, thanks for nothing. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.